They say, but it's getting so much better. There are Negro mayors. There's Negroes in all of sports. There are Negroes in politics. They're even accorded the ultimate accolade of being in television commercials now. I'm glad you're smiling. Is it at once getting much better and still hopeless?
Well, I don't think there's much hope for it, you know, to tell you the truth. You know, as long as people are using this peculiar language. It's what I was trying to convey before when I said that it's not a question of what happens to the Negro here, or to the black man here. That's a very vivid question for me, you know. But the real question is what's going to happen to this country. I have to repeat that. Now, if Negroes, you know, don't seem to be very optimistic, it's not because they suddenly all change from happy, shiftless, dancing darkies down on the levee, picking all that cotton and singing praises to the master. Mm-hmm. They've not changed at all. They never were optimistic. All one's got to do is listen to Swing Low, Sweet Chariot and ask yourself what that song's about. Or try to really listen to what Ray Charles is really telling you. We have lived under these intolerable conditions for how many years? Nearly 400 years. We have evolved a certain kind of style to meet it. And a lot of that has been involved with the lies we had to tell to you. And the lies we had to tell to you, this compounds the disaster you believe because you wanted to believe it. But obviously you knew, every white man knows, that he would not himself, you know, lying track for nothing. He would not himself allow his child to be sold from him as though the child were a mule. He would not himself allow himself not to have the autonomy of his own house and his own woman. He would not himself pick all that cotton and carry it to market just because he loved white people. We all know that. And the word Negro in this country is designed finally to disguise the fact that when it's talking about another man, a man like you, who wants what you want. And insofar as the American Republic wants to think there has been progress, they overlook one very simple thing. I don't want to be given anything by you. I just want you to leave me alone so I can do it myself.
Welcome, welcome, welcome to the Help Myself Podcast. Listen, I am your host, John M. Singletary Sr. I got to put that senior in there because I got my junior in there, man. Woke up this morning in the greatest of moods and is playing music and singing and dancing. I love it. And I put that senior in there because it is a privilege to travel on this journey of not only podcasting, but of life with my co-pilot, John M. Singletary Jr., a.k.a. LJ, who I do it with and who I do it for. And so I am excited to be back with another episode of the Help Myself Podcast. Listen, it is Black History Month. I got on my shirt, Black History Month. And it has month crossed out, and at the bottom it says period. You know, I'm grateful somebody that just knows how I feel about t-shirts and knows how I feel about other things, thought of me and sent this to me. So thank you for that. And so today we're going to talk about James Baldwin, one of my favorite. Listen, there's so much about him. I want to get into him more. And I want to talk about his unique ability to always turn the conversation from looking at it one way and switching the issue to a different lens. Because a lot of times when we are discussing an issue, someone will discuss it with us with what I like to call second question perspective. Second question perspective just basically means there is a question that you have asked and assumed my answer already. And when you let me into the conversation, we are on the second question with the assumption that I would answer the first question in a certain way. What James Baldwin had an amazing ability to do is to take that question, that conversation, and take it back and boil it down to the real issue and not be falsely solved portion of the issue that was trying to be presented to him. So we're going to first pay some bills, and then we'll come back and talk about looking at the issue from a different lens. Q Images. It's a world-class, veteran-owned and operated Las Vegas-based photography company. Whether you need on-site or in-studio or on-location photography, be prepared to receive top-notch, innovative, and high-level professionalism from Q Images. While other photographers take photos, Q Images captures moments and creates memories. So go to qimages.smugmug.com or Instagram at Q_UE_images. Again, that is at Q_UE_images. Make sure you go and check them out. Tell them we sent you from the Help Myself podcast. And when you see the fly visuals, know that Q Images had a hand in it. Check them out. Man, you know, I always got to come. I'm going to fix that, but I always had to come in here and say, Q Images didn't have a hand in it. He is the reason for it. So, yeah, man, go check out Q Images on Instagram, man, and get tapped in and tuned in. Listen, have money, will travel. Look, if you're looking for the type of photography that will change the trajectory of your brand, Q Images is the one. Veteran owned. Operated by my brother, Timothy Quisenberry. So check it out. Check it out. Listen, so today, man, we're talking about looking at an issue from a different lens, which is a very important leadership trait. It's a very important relationship trait. It's a very important life trait. I've talked about a phenomenon called Sonder. And what Sonder is the realization that others are experiencing life in a different way than you are, even when it is seemingly the same experience. And a lot of times we frame conversations based on how we're perceiving or experiencing them without taking into consideration that there are other people that are having a different and sometimes dramatically different experience in the exact same situation. And that is the crux and litmus of what we do in these diversity, equity, and inclusion spaces. It's not enough to just say we want to promote diversity. It's not enough to say that we want equity. It's not enough to just say that we want inclusion. But we need to look at those perspectives and find a way. And that's why we moved so much from equality to equity, because equality just says, hey, you know, there was a reason why you weren't able to have things. So let's just give you all the things that you don't have. And now everybody has the same thing. Equity says there are situations, conditions, and systems that were put in place that put you at a disadvantage that caused you to be in a situation where you don't have the things, whether it be actual things, access, permissions, all of these things. You don't have these. So not only did we restrict you, but we set up a system that while you were being restricted, this system diminished your abilities to be able to do what you would normally be capable of doing. And so what equity says is we're going to answer the bell on how we robbed you of opportunities and resources. And then we're going to restore you to a level once we've addressed and made retribution for the way we've harmed you by keeping you from. Then we're going to add the resources to bring you to a level that we can call equal. But equal is not just, oh, they had 100,000, so I give you 100,000. When I was talented enough to make a million and you actively prevented me from making that, and then you think that you have paid me back for all my trouble by just giving me 100,000 when you've actively kept me from making far more than that and setting in processes that are able to make that continuous. And so James Baldwin was very important in the fact that he brought so much. So there's so many ways that I just like to talk about him as genius level in the way that he was able to challenge, to bring forth ideas and to challenge norms and to challenge how we feel. Like, I love the clip. He says, "No, you want to talk about things getting better for the Negro," which Negro was still a common term when I was growing up. I was born in the 1900s. So Negro was definitely still a common term when I was born and when I was coming up. And it was always this question of, well, we've given y'all so much. Isn't it better for you now? You know, don't you have enough to be happy? And I always thought about how ridiculous that question is, because I don't want it to be better than it was. I want what you started with, the total freedom to be a whole human being. You know, so this idea that somehow you are in such a high position that I have to earn my humanity from you. And I think too often we don't boil it down to that. That the same opportunities, one of the jokes that we used to make is, you know, when I was coming up, you know, you got movies like, we laugh because some of the movies with black leads in them were not really great movies. They didn't, you know, they didn't age well. You know, you're like, wow, that has no storyline to it or whatever. But we definitely support them so much because I came up in a time where it was not a normal thing to see a black lead man or woman in a movie. You know, we maybe would get a supporting role, we'll be a secondary character. Early on, man, we was like the maid and the butler and the servants, you know. So to see a black movie with a black lead told from a black viewpoint was a big deal. And so we supported it for that reason. And that was the issue, you know. People don't understand that the conversation is based on the fact that our viewpoints aren't seen. And so James Baldwin is important to me because, one, you know, he's a writer, he's a civil rights activist. He definitely fought for the liberation of black people, the gay liberation movement. He was an openly gay man. He was also an expat, moved to France, you know, lived in France, and, you know, talked about how racism was different there. What he never said was that racism didn't exist there, but what he did say was that he didn't feel his race in the same way. So he garnered acclaim for his work across several forms. I have a couple of his books. One of my favorites is Price of the Ticket. It's a collection, and you know, plays, poems, novels. His first novel was Go Tell It on the Mountain, published a couple of years before my mom was born, and it was actually included on Time Magazine's list of the 100 best English language novels. So, you know, when you think about that, one of my favorites of his works was Notes of a Native Son. And what he did masterfully was that he posed the fundamental questions amid all of this complex social and psychological pressure that racism, sexism, patriarchy, misogynist. Me and a friend of mine, we recently just got into it, talking about all of the groups that are represented or misrepresented, and when you talk about ageism and ableism, and it's just amazing that when you are a part of the normative group, how you don't think about your normative traits. You only think about the groups that make you a part of a particular marginalized community. You know, so he would talk about themes of masculinity, of sexuality, of race, of class, and he would create these narratives. And it was amazing how a lot of times his writing and his narratives, he made them, weave them to run like parallel with a lot of the major political movements towards social change, you know, the civil rights movement, gay liberation. And often his protagonists were Black, gay, bisexual men. Obviously, next week we're going to get into another spot. But, you know, he spoke to a truth that he was very familiar with. And I did. So last week we highlighted Nikki Giovanni, who I acclaim as the living legend, and a conversation that he had with her and to spotlight her. And so this week I just knew that we were going to spotlight James Baldwin. So he was born in 1924 in New York City and passed at the age of 63 in 1987 in France. And he is a well-known writer and activist. So when we talk about looking at issues from a different lens with the thought of James Baldwin, you know, I started that out like using the ideal of the second question perspective, where the first question is asked and answered before the person it should be asked to has had a chance to even be aware of the question. So you move into a second question with the assumption of what they would answer without actually understanding. So the question that was posed to him is, why is the Negro not optimistic with all of the good that has happened? And he took that and condensed it down and took it back to the place where it needed to be. At what point were we optimistic? And why is it that you giving us what you think that we should get a reason for our optimism? You know, like, we know a lot of us came over in slavery. A lot of people were born into slavery and this, that, and the other. So we understand that. But, you know, and this is something that I speak about in my personal experiences in the education system here in the United States. When, to quote Goody Mob, when I was in school, I was told, I was bought, I was sold. You know, and that is how you talk about the lineage. Whereas, you know, and I went to majority Black schools for the majority of my life, but whenever I was in another class, you know, it was just amazing, especially with the information that I had, to watch them be able to be taught very romanticized versions of their lineage, of their history. You know, they were heroes, they were creators, they were inventors, they were progenitors of freedom and democracy. And I was a slave. And I had the privilege of being freed by a kind president that didn't think it was fair that I was a slave. And so then Martin Luther King fought for my civil rights, and now all is well. And nothing could be further from the truth. Like, everything that I said in that statement can be verified as false statements, or at least partially false, it's narrative building. And how important it was to never allow us to see ourselves as something just as great, you know, like historical whitewashing of characters. Come to find out that some of these great historical people were actually of African descent, to find out, you know, what the world looked like at the time, and what we're, you know, just all of that. So a different perspective and looking at the issue from a different lens. And again, like I talked about DEI, one of the amazing things about looking at your marginalized groupings versus your prominent groupings. So it's one thing for me as a Black man, I understand that being Black is a marginalized group. I've had a litany of experiences, from being funny and charming and hilarious in a moment of education to being detrimental to my health, to being situations that could almost cost me my life simply because the color of my skin. I don't mourn it. I'm not sitting around here sad about it. It is what it is, you know? I mean, that's life, right? I've been doing this thing for the better part of almost 50 years now. You know, there's some things you accept. I remember E.T., the hip-hop preacher, once saying that he was proud of the progress we were starting to make because as a man at the time, in his mid-40s, he had thought, you know, hey, racism is just going to be something that's always going to be here. Do we feel like that's going to change? I don't know. But I always feel I've learned in my leadership journey that a fight worth fighting does not necessarily mean that you're guaranteed to win it. It's just worth fighting because it's the right thing to do. And it's amazing to understand how much our entire humanity is impacted by the isms that we practice, you know? And so looking at issues from a different lens, when we talk about our marginalized group, I could lead with my blackness, but what was very eye-opening for me was to lead from my stance in preferred groups. So you'll rarely hear me talk about my status as a man, because as a man, you know, I've always had the right to do things that men could do that women couldn't do. And to find out that, you know, it's the late 70s, early 80s, women didn't have the permission to have checking accounts and credit cards on their own. They had to pass an act in 1979 so that they had permission to do that. And to think about how they had to navigate a world in which they couldn't work certain jobs. They were financially restricted, didn't have permission, as if they were children. You know, and then I listen to some of these podcasts when they talk about men and women relationships and what marriage is supposed to look like. And I realize that we always take the historical piece out of there that, you know, you know, we romanticize marriage and do not realize that the romantic aspect of marriage started in the Middle Ages, the 14, 1500s. But prior to that, marriage was a contract, and women had no say-so in this contract. And so when you look at the situation of multiple marriages, it's historically, you know, put in there. We see it, but we like to skim over it because it was the royalty. But oftentimes people would use marriages as a way to marry themselves up with families with resources so they could share those resources and make business deals and things like that. There's even been some research to start that communities used to feel responsible for all of the children in the community. So it wasn't as necessary for maternity, paternity, or who was a husband, who's a wife, because the community was one and they made sure that everybody was taken care of. But as issues of owning land and the division of property, so now you have to look at what belongs to me because of the resources that I need to be able to take care of my land and to protect my property. And then as that grew out. And so that's interesting research. That's an interesting topic. And so, as man, I went down the rabbit hole on that one. Let's get out the rabbit hole. Looking at the marginalized groups that I'm not a part of and realizing how I don't feel any need to talk about or lead with that. I am not part of a marginalized group as far as religion. The preferred religion here in the United States is Christianity. If you are a part of another religion, it becomes almost like an albatross that you have to carry, or a scarlet letter, you know, that you have to carry, you know, you have to lead with, because people think you're something different, you know, that people of Muslim faith or people of Jewish faith or people of other different faiths, you're looked at a certain way. You know, if you say that you don't subscribe to a particular religion, there's a judgment to that. That's a marginalization. One of the things that we think about, especially in my family, in my household, is that this is a special needs household. And so when I go places, you know, I'm always checking the ADA, you know, Americans with Disability Act, and, you know, what is the access, and, you know, things like that. A lot of people, I can tell when people invite me to do things or say, they don't think about the disability that's involved or the special need in my family and how I have to be careful of these things, and I have to think that through. And, you know, one of the worst parts is that people assume that it's easy because I carry it out without complaining. And so they think, oh, well, you did this or that, just do this. You know, and how rude it is to say to somebody, you don't know what it requires for somebody to show up. And so just to assume that they can show up in ways that you think because you don't understand their struggle, that's not looking at the issue from the correct lens. And so in leadership, when it comes to looking at these issues, it becomes an ability to not lead from your own perspective. I remember talking to a senior leader once, and he said, hey, you know, when I was in that, we used to have to do it like this. So I don't know why they shouldn't have to do it like this. But that was probably one of the best decisions that I made in my senior leadership journey, is to let go of some of the control, to allow the ideas. I remember my team wanted to dramatically change. They wanted to change a goaling process that had took almost 10 years to formulate. And mentally, I struggled with it a little bit, but, you know, I knew it was the right thing. I knew they were seeing things from a different perspective, and I knew it could be very good for our team. So, yeah, we changed it. And it wasn't so much, oh, my God, the idea was great. It was the buy-in. It was allowing people to come forward and be seen and heard, and it was something that didn't take nothing from me, you know? And a lot didn't take anything from me because I had the privilege of knowing that I was there to serve others and not to create some kind of monument to myself to be remembered by. So that was one of the benefits. But when leading, you know, I think about a relationship. I was looking at Dear Future Wifey, LaTerrence Whitfield, and he had Kevin and Melissa Fredericks on there, and you may know them as Kev on Stage and Mrs. Kev on Stage. And if you've never personally, I've talked about them a lot. There's a lot that inspires me about the journey of Kev on Stage. I'm a huge fan and been following for a while, and I really love everything he's doing. And they were just talking about relationships. They wrote a book called Marriage Be Hard. And they were just talking about the changes and how seeing something. And he was saying that sometimes it's hard when she's got something going on, because he's coming from his perspective of, you know, abandonment and maybe not being seen as a child. And so his perspective is, I did something wrong. And sometimes it don't even be, a lot of times it don't even be him. She's going through something on her end and the way she was raised, and, you know, learning to calm himself down and say, hey, you didn't do anything wrong. Now be here. And she talks about a time where she was going through waking up in a funk and knowing that she didn't want to be in a funk, and then couldn't get herself out of a funk. And now she's even feeling worse because she's judging herself for being in the funk. And instead of doing all the things that we do when dealing with other people, he just came over and was like, hey, you're not feeling good. You want a hug? You know what's wrong? And, you know, just showing kindness. And she said it just caused her to break, because she's like, I know I'm not being a nice person. You're being nice to me. He's able to see it from a different lens, because he would have been well within his rights to see that as she tripping and not. And so I think it's important. I think a lot of times there are bad actors, okay? And y'all pardon the noise, you know, LJ is, you know, out here doing his thing. But a lot of times they're bad actors. And what looking at it from a different lens is sometimes they will try to fool you with language. And looking at it from a different lens, that was one thing that James Baldwin had an amazing skill at, is he would boil that thing down to the actual concept so that they couldn't get away. And so many times you would just hear them get upset, and, you know, because he basically boiled it down to, you think you're better. And that's the beginning and end of the conversation. But when it comes to looking at somebody, sometimes people have just learned and internalized things and they don't know. I'm always amazed at how much world history, specifically African history and Black history here in the United States, that I know that people don't know. And then I have to remember, oh, I didn't get that out of school or anything. I had to do personal research to learn these things. And a lot of people don't know. And a lot of times you have conversations. I used to get frustrated because, you know, I get questions like, well, why Black people complain about this? And what about that? Isn't this racist or that racist? And I'm just like, why don't y'all know this stuff? But, you know, if you didn't go out and feel, you know, I think part of growing up, the way that I grew up, there was a desire to learn more and something better for me. And so I have a lot of knowledge and information. And so sometimes, instead of getting upset, because, you know, if you went through an educational process and you're pleased with it and you learned what you wanted to learn, it built you up in a certain way, why would you feel the need to try to learn other stuff? Especially if it fits your narrative. Yeah, sometimes I have to take a minute to pause and understand that there may be an opportunity to learn something there. Or they might be a jerk and just want to continue to believe what they want to believe. So we got space for that too. And we got ways to handle that. But a lot of times in life, in leadership, in relationships, in interpersonal dealings, sometimes it's important to look at the issue from a different lens. A lot of times we start off, I'm right, instead of, let me gather as much information so that I can make an informed decision and move in a way that works well for me and everything that I'm concerned with. So, a shout out to James Baldwin for inspiring this. And before we go, how about we pay some more bills? Hey, I know y'all see me out here in these fly shirts in these internet streets. Some of y'all are even blessed enough to see me in the real streets with it, hey? And whether it's a shirt that says Black on Black Fine, or this, that premium chocolate, or Busy Flourishing, one of my favorites, many things can be discounted. My worth isn't one of them. Or patiently waiting on someone's well-raised daughter. You know who keeps me fitted up? It's all about Merchandere. Yep, Merchandere, free spirited apparel. They got a shirt or a hoodie that'll speak to your soul too. So let me tell you what to do. Just head on over to Merchandere.com. That's MERCHANAIRE.com. Grab you some apparel that speaks to you and speaks for you. Merchandere, baby. All right, y'all. So as we come to the close of another episode of the Help Myself podcast, brought to you by John M. Singletary Sr. and Jr., LJ in the building. Listen, I want you to take an opportunity to look at issues, situations, thoughts, and perspectives from a different lens. Practice it in your relationships and your dealings and your conversations. Practice it in your own life. There might be a situation where you're anchoring your own opinion over the actual lived experience of somebody else. There's so much more depth to this conversation that I could have brought. And so it is definitely my desire that it will at least spark a conversation. And who knows, we might come back and talk about this from so many other lenses. One of the lenses that I thought about was the first female enlisted lead of a United States military force, and how we keep talking about these firsts, when there's another perspective to it. They were only the first because they were lawfully not allowed to be in certain positions. And sometimes we use this term, the first woman to do this, as if women weren't gifted, talented, intelligent, and able to do these jobs before, which is obviously not the case. The case is that they were lawfully restricted and socially kept from doing these jobs. And so that's why it's important to look at an issue from a different lens, because sometimes the narrative is created to make us feel and act in a way that might be inauthentic and at worst could be harmful to others. So I will close like I always do. Listen, I can't help myself. Got to inspire, I've got to encourage, I've got to empower, but I can help myself by being the absolute best version of myself. And guess what? You can too. So why not we do it together?